everyone. Hope you've all been well. This week, I spoke with Tamás Vonjo. Tamás is Associate Professor at the University of Bocconi at the Department of Social and Political Sciences. And today we're going to talk about his work on post-war European economic growth. Tamás has published extensively on this, as demonstrated by his recent book, The Economic Consequences of the War, West Germany's Growth Miracle After 1945. That was published by Cambridge University Press in 2018. The book summarizes many of Tamás's early articles, as well as adding new insights. And in today's discussion, we discuss why Western Europe's economic experience following World War II was so different to Eastern Europe's, beginning with the shock of World War II. Towards the end of the discussion, we look in particular at the 1980s and consider what caused the Eastern European communist bloc to start collapsing. Tamás wrote a really interesting piece with Alex Klein called Why Did Socialist Economies Fail? The Role of Factor Inputs Reconsidered. That was published the year after his book in the Economic History Review in 2019. I really enjoyed having Tamás on the show. Tamás was very generous with his time, so I hope you enjoy what I thought was a really rich presentation from Tamás. Take care of yourselves, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. So, Professor Tamás Vonjo, thank you very much for agreeing to do this with us on the Economic History Podcast. It's a real pleasure. First of all, I'd like to ask you how you got interested in this field to begin with, how you got into economic history.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for this invitation. It's a great opportunity to talk about my work and my motivations for getting into economic history. I hope that several members from our profession will have the opportunity to listen to this podcast. How I got into economic history is really a long story, and it has to do a lot with the fact that I wasn't born in and raised in one of the countries where most members of the economic history profession come from. I was born in Hungary when it was still a socialist country, and I spent most of my teenage years in a very difficult post-socialist transition. In order to achieve what I have achieved internationally in the past 10, 20 years or so, my motivation had to come from a very early age. So the first motivation was really my father. He is a retired historian. He worked on Hungarian political history in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s. And really, his story, in a way, is a good summary of what happened to Eastern Europe in the post-war era. So my dad was born on the very first day of peace after World War II in Hungary, and grew up in the post-war misery that characterized the region. He was really born into abject poverty. My grandparents were very poorly educated. My grandmother was practically functionally illiterate. I remember my grandpa reading the newspaper in the morning and then my grandma using it for packing, right? So, and from this background, my father, as a member of a large generation of first generation literati in Eastern Europe, got to an academic position or got to enter academia in a way that would have been, I guess, impossible under any different institutional regime than state socialism. So my father, as a consequence, was not only interested in history, but also in politics, in international affairs. So he had this interdisciplinary interest. And that got me interested very early on in history, in geography, in what we would say economics or international affairs. And I began to read extensively first when I was about 12 or 13. And my first inspirations were just military history. The first books that I've read were more like historical novels or popular histories. The best known internationally was probably the classic book of Tarle on Napoleon. It's a big doorstop on very beautifully written on the French Wars. And then when I was a bit older, now in high school, about 16, 17, I got interested in international history, particularly in the international history of the late 19th century. And this is a very typical thing of what can happen if you grow up in a peripheral country. It's very difficult to access there the recent international literature because it would you will not find it in the libraries that are close to you. So the works of the Western canon that I had access to early on were either the real international bestsellers of the time that for some reason got quickly translated into Hungarian and published in Hungary. So in the 1990s, this meant, among others, the works of Paul Kennedy. For the younger audience in this podcast, Kennedy was a member of this famous Yale School of International History in the 1970s, 1980s, was extremely prominent and became world known, especially after he published The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers in 87. And that book, plus a couple of other works that he wrote in the early 90s, got very quickly published in Hungary. And then the other types of works that you would be able to read were actually classics and outdated classics. It's very often the case that, you know, books would be published or translated into other languages and published 30, 40 years after their initial publication, once they had already become part of the international canon. So it was interesting that when Kennedy's works were published in Hungary in the 90s, it was exactly the same time when they began to publish A.G.P. Taylor, right? This time, 40 years after Taylor had published these classics. So while I was reading The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers from Kennedy, I was also reading things like Taylor's work on Bismarck or the Habsburg Empire or the international system in the 19th century. So my first inspiration was academic inspiration, was partly economic history, partly international history of the Belle Epoque, or what we commonly refer to as the end of the long 19th century. And that was that time that I got the opportunity of a lifetime in the form of an international scholarship to a very prominent high school in Canada, where I was studying for the IB in my last two high school years, and where I not only learned English at a level that was required for advanced study, but also had truly inspirational teachers in both economics and history. And that's where really I realized the very important link between these two professions, also in line with what I was reading in the international history of the long 19th century. And then I also decided immediately then to pursue this kind of career. So I was already applying for or applying to universities where I would be able to study these two subjects together. I did very well in the IB, so I had the luck to get admitted to many different schools, including Oxford and top Canadian universities. But then reality punched me in the face, and I had to realize that I'm still from Hungary and I'm still from a poor family. So since I didn't get full scholarships to any of these universities, I had to go back to my native Hungary. I won't talk about the personal side of this experience because really my early 20s were a terrible time. I was very depressed about this, but I picked myself up and I knew that I want to get out of there again and pursue this career through postgraduate studies. And then I decided to pursue my own studies, my own interest in economic history, read a lot extracurricularly, and I even began a publishing career in Hungary. So I basically had two careers in economic history, one before my graduate studies in Oxford in Hungary, and then one since. And first I published in line with my earlier interests in Hungarian journals on British and German foreign policy and the economics behind this foreign policy in the late 19th century. And then gradually my interests turned to a later period, to post-Second World War Europe. The main motivation here was partly my undergraduate education. So in Hungary, I studied, college in Hungary for me was in a school that was basically an international business slash international relations school. And I participated in a program that focused, where most subjects focused on the economics and the politics of European integration. This was just before Eastern European countries were to join the EU. So these schools were training a lot of, you know, new cadres for the country's new role in Europe. So this turned my attention towards these international institutions that we economic historians know of as post-war institutions. Plus, I won a few small scholarships with which I could spend a few months at top German universities, either in summer university courses or in small research positions for undergraduate students. So I spent a month in Heidelberg, then 2 months in Tübingen, a couple of weeks in Munich. And there I finally had the access I always wanted to the international literature. So this was the first time that I could also read the recent works published in journals, both German journals and international economic history journals, where I could get access to the best monographs, edited volumes on the topic. And here my main inspiration on post-war economic history that then really defined my way of thinking about this was the major textbook on post-war, first West German and then later German economic history, written by Werner Rabelshauser. And it was a really inspiring book for two reasons. One is because of the first sentence in the book, which literally means that the history of the Federal Republic of Germany, so West Germany, is above all its economic history. So this was very inspiring to me because it was a powerful example how economics and economic development matters for the historical trajectory of a country, for its international standing, even the identity of its people. And secondly, it was a very inspiring work for me because Rabelshauser and his generation of German economic historians who wrote a revisionist interpretation of the post-war growth story from the 1980s onwards, drew one of its inspirations from a very strange Hungarian economist and an exotic book that he published in the late 60s. In preparation for this interview, you told me, Sean, that if we can find something exotic, it's even better. So there you go. There is a Hungarian economist, Ferenc Jánosi, who published a theory of post-war growth in the late 1960s, first in Hungarian in 66, then in German in 67, and then it finally got published in English as well. I mean, he's a strange figure. He's not really an economist. He's a self-made economist. He was trained as an engineer in the 1940s, both in Nazi Germany and then in the Stalinist Soviet Union. So that's an interesting background itself. Yeah. And then he got into economics because he was a top guy in the Central Planning Bureau of Hungary in the 1950s. And then he became a research economist. Now, his idea in a nutshell was that there is a semi-automatic reconversion of economies to their long-run growth path or their long-run productive potential in the post-war period, so that these growth miracles were not policy miracles or the product of historical fortune, but really just automatic reconversions to a productive potential that is essentially based on human capital and technical know-how. And the reason why you have very fast growth in the post-war period is because there is a big output gap due to either destruction or dislocation. And the post-war miracles, including the German growth miracle, were just a product of the elimination of this output gap and reconvergence to a growth path. Now, when I read both the German literature on this and then some of the few cliometric papers that were published in the 1990s and the early 2000s, I realized that I can do something on this because all these international scholars only knew Janosch's work from one book. That is not a very well-written book. The English translation is absolutely horrible. So it's very, if you read the English version, it's very difficult to actually understand what this guy means. And as opposed to these people, I thought that now I'm the guy from the periphery. I have an advantage. I actually know this better. I've read the original in Hungarian. I've read all the other works of this economist published at the same time. I've read the academic discussions, debates that happened or occurred in the late 60s, early 70s, based on Janosch's work in the Hungarian economics profession. So I had a deeper understanding of his work, of his theory. But because I saw that there was a current literature, including in quantitative economic history, this actually gave me a motivation to write a research proposal that might be interesting to top graduate schools. With this, I got into Oxford, eventually got a scholarship. And this also was very good because it led to my first publication that I managed to publish during my PhD, precisely on this topic. Basically trying, this was my paper in the European Review in 2008 that simply tried to better test, or first provide a better understanding for this theory and how it compares to more mainstream Western neoclassical theories that we know of post-war growth, and how we can test it better than the previous papers. So, you know, this is kind of my long story into economic history.
That's quite an answer. So that's questions one and two.
Yes.
I would say what you've just said for students who are starting out and looking for a way in, it's a really nice piece of advice. If you can tap into an international literature, having access to something in your native tongue. So a lot of your work deals with what you've just talked about, which is the long shadow of World War II, both in Eastern and Western Europe. What I want to start with, and we all know that World War II was bad, but could you present some sort of headline figures, economic statistics, which are relevant to convey how bad the picture really was?
One of the things that I understood throughout my graduate studies, and especially in my postgraduate work, is that even though I had this theoretical or growth theoretical motivation to work on this topic, I had to realize that these, you know, single factor theories are not going to get you very far in understanding both the dynamics of post-war reconstruction and then also the effects of the disruptive effects of World War II and the post-war settlements. This is a multifaceted picture. And sorry, not so much in my papers and my book published on this topic, but especially in the last couple of years when I was asked, or as I was asked to talk about this to different audiences, I developed an easy way to summarize this, especially for economists. So to economists, I like to say that you can think about the effects of the economic effects of major calamities like the world wars as five Ds. So these are destruction. That means, you know, the destruction of physical capital of any form, death. So the loss of human life and therefore loss of human capital, displacement. That means displacement of people, especially between countries, dislocation. That means, misallocation of otherwise available factors of production. And finally, disintegration. So basically the economic implications of border changes.
Okay.
Now, each of these were very significant. As I will say later, I mean, this is a recurring story, much more significant in Eastern Europe than in Western Europe. But each of them are very important. Physical destruction in World War II was completely unprecedented. There is no war in the history of mankind that saw so much physical destruction, especially because of the destructive power of new technologies, especially aerial bombardment, but also heavy artillery. Then you have, I mean, we know that more people died in this war than most recorded wars of human history combined, right? So loss of human life is incredible. There are many countries where this is 10, 20% of the population. Tens of millions of people are displaced in Europe after the war. Disintegration is a huge problem. I mean, first of all, World War II shut down the global economy practically for a couple of years. So trade disintegration is enormous and unprecedented, but also especially in the eastern half of Europe. But then with decolonization in the early post-war years around the world, border changes are dramatic. And economies are also dislocated in different ways, but it's very important that each of these factors are also interacting. That makes the story even more complex. And what is crucial in comparative economic history is to realize that each of them had a very differential impact across countries, across regions within large countries, and also between industries and even firms. So in order to understand post-war economic development, we have to have a very good picture of each of these disruptive effects of the war. And we have to realize that this can be dramatically different in different regions of the world, different regions of Europe, and between countries or within countries.
And yet, despite all of this devastation for Western Europe, the growth miracle that followed, you have attributed to three sort of independent factors or interdependent factors. The first of which was what you call a large growth potential. Could we, first of all, explain this before getting into the other two?
Sure. So this follows on this general framework that I just set out. If you look at any of these 5Ds, so any of these major disruptive economic consequences of the war, you realize that in most of Western Europe, they were remarkably mild or weak. And that means that the foundations for continued growth and for rapid recovery were there in most countries. Yes, millions of lives were lost, but actually most Western European countries had a smaller casualty rate than in World War I, despite the fact that World War II killed so many people globally. And these population losses were more than offset, in some countries much more than offset, by continued natural population growth and also post-war displacement of people, millions who ended up in Western Europe. So let's say a few things about both of these. Natural population growth, World War II was a different story, especially in Western Europe, than World War I. So if you looked at, if demographic historians would know this, until very recently, if you looked at the demographic tree of any European country, you would have a very big gap for the birth cohorts between, say, 1915 and 1919. And that was the effect of trench warfare, right? So in trench warfare, the young men were away from home for a very, very lengthy period of time. And this, of course, cut down fertility dramatically. World War II was fought in a very different way, especially for Western European countries. So you don't have this very negative effect on natural births. And then you have a second factor that after World War II, there is a lot of displacement from different regions of the world towards Western Europe. In the case of West Germany, or post-war Germany in general, this was the displacement of ethnic Germans either fleeing from the advancing Red Army in Central Europe or post-war expelled from Eastern Central European countries. And in many other Western European countries, most notably Britain and France, but not only, this is colonial repatriation that happens in very big numbers in the late 1940s. Then physical destruction in most Western European countries was very small. The exceptions are certain regions of Italy and then most of West Germany. But even here, destruction meant destruction of housing and also other urban and transport infrastructure. Productive capacity was much bigger, especially in manufacturing, even in these countries after the war than before, partly because of very heavy investment in the rearmament period and the early war years, and partly because industrial factories were not the main targets of bombing or, you know, sieges by ground forces. Then also because there were not major border changes in Western Europe, except the division of Germany. Therefore, in countries other than Germany, disintegration, dislocation because of these border changes was also not a major factor. Displacement was, but this really was limited to the late 1940s and not beyond. So this is why the physical foundations for normal economic activity and continued growth and rapid recovery were there in practically all Western European countries. It was really geopolitical and international factors that limited recovery in the late 1940s, at least in Western Europe.
We spoke about three factors. That was the first one. The other two are quite interrelated. You talked about Germany and East Germany and West Germany, and I've seen you've written the centrality of Germany. What were the other two factors with respect to this?
As I said, what limited European recovery, Western European recovery beyond, say, 1947, 1948, were geopolitical factors. So two things had to be solved in order for this existing growth potential in Western Europe to be mobilized, to which, by the way, you can also add a better known story or a more conventional Western story of, you know, the closing of a transatlantic productivity gap between Western Europe and the United States after the war. So you have both this war-induced growth potential because the foundation survived very well World War II. And then you have this potential of rapid catch-up with a technologically more advanced United States that we know from the work of Nelson and Wright, and then from many European economic historians, but also a catch-up in human capital following an early start in with high school and university education in the US that we know from the work of Claudia Goldin. So what limited the mobilization of this growth potential were two factors. One, as I said already, World War II completely shut down economic globalization for at least a couple of years. And it was very difficult to rebuild trade and both economic and political cooperation between countries in Western Europe. After all, these nations were literally killing each other for years. So there was a limited willingness to cooperate internationally. We know this is a well-known story. There was a pandemic dollar shortage, so shortage of hard currency in Western Europe that limited the restarting of international trade, both within the continent and with the United States. And it's unquestionable that solving this problem and restarting Western economic cooperation could not have happened without a very positive and instrumental role played by the United States, right? So a lot has been written on the Marshall Plan and the institutions it had established, but the consensus on this since the late 1990s at least has been that the main impact of the Marshall Plan for post-war recovery was not the aid itself or the investments it generated in different countries, but the fact that it really convinced Western European countries to cooperate, even and especially former enemies. And it also created the institutions, but also the incentives for rebuilding global trade and global finance, at least within the Western alliance. The other problem was the German question and how to deal with the German question after two world wars. This was already a problem we know after World War I. Now it was an even bigger problem because Germany was completely defeated and occupied by the Allies. And although the German question was solved in a difficult way that led to the division of Germany in 1948-1949, but it was solved in a way, once again, thanks to American involvement, American leadership, and the Marshall Plan, that allowed the German economy to rebuild very quickly, to rebuild its industrial potential by the 1950s, and to reintegrate into the Western economic order. And it's clear that without this, no sound Western recovery or the rebuilding of the Western European economy and Western European trade would have been possible. So it means that because of this, you know, a lot of people viewed this reconstruction story and this literature based on or inspired by growth theory, either by the reconstruction thesis or by neoclassical catch-up and convergence, as kind of a revisionist interpretation that downplays the importance of post-war institutions. Instead, we should look at the role of post-war institutions in a different way. So these post-war institutions were not the ones that created the potential for growth that was there, but they were essentially mobilizing the potential for growth because these economies had become so interconnected in the 19th and 20th centuries, these industrial economies, that rebuilding trade and international finance and rebuilding Germany and allowing it to take its traditional role in this Western economic system were both essential preconditions for this very successful rebuilding of Western Europe economically in the 1950s and 60s.
So before we speak about the East, you have written that we cannot evaluate its subsequent performance without taking into consideration the vastly different starting point after World War II that it had experienced. You've already talked about the West. Can we explain what was so different about the East and what you've called a demographic disaster?
Yes. So once again, we can go back to these five Ds, right? That's why I like this framework. It works very well. You can take any of them. The impact on Eastern Europe in general and most individual countries in Eastern Europe as well is vastly bigger and more negative than in Western Europe or pretty much any region in the world. Maybe the only comparable is certain areas in East Asia. So first, you know, let's not even talk about death. Let's leave that to the end. So physical destruction is enormous. You know, there are some major cities in Eastern Europe that are not properly rebuilt until the end of the 50s. Warsaw is a good example, but also Leningrad or today St. Petersburg is a good example. So some cities took like 15 years to rebuild after World War II. Then disintegration is a completely different story in the East and the West. I mean, in Western Europe, there are hardly any border changes. I mean, very minor border changes. The only significant thing is really the division of Germany. In Eastern Europe, there is practically no border that stays the same between 1939 and 1949, right? Some of the borders change multiple times. It's partly because of the westward expansion of the Soviet Union is basically pushing countries westwards, most notably Poland, but there are also other border changes, both during the war, very significant border changes during the war and also after the war. This means that there's a lot of dislocation as well. So, you know, input-output links between that existed in different industries between different countries are completely disrupted by these changes. But really the most outstanding consequence, negative consequence of World War II is what happens to human resources. Most of the war deaths in World War II are actually happening in Eastern Europe. More than half of the global death toll is in Eastern Europe. About one third in the Soviet Union itself. But also there is huge displacement after the war. And particularly because of the fleeing and then expulsion of ethnic Germans, in total about somewhere between 12 and 14 million, Eastern Europe also loses a lot of people after the war, basically as a consequence of the post-war settlement. Also, there are millions of people that leave the region because of the advancing, or either running away from the advancing Red Army or because they don't want to stay in the region once the communists are taking power. So if you add up all of these things, if you want one big statistic, the 1940s removed about 55 million souls from Eastern Europe. Right? It's 10 times the Holocaust. By the way, the Holocaust is an Eastern European story as well, because about 85% of the victims are from Eastern Europe. So, you know, you have this enormous loss of human capital, whereas at the same time, as I said, most Western European countries have a significantly bigger population by 1950 than they had by 1939. And in many Eastern European countries, it's also a very differential loss of human capital that specifically hit very hard the best educated parts of the population or those who dominated the most progressive sectors of the economy. So let's take the example of just one country, Poland, where this is really apocalyptic, this story. So the area that becomes Poland in 1945 lost about 20% of its population due to both or during the war and then post-war displacement. But this meant almost a 40% loss initially of the urban population, so people living in the biggest cities. But because of the Holocaust and the expulsion of ethnic Germans, you have certain industries where up to 50% of the workforce is gone. If you take both academic intellectuals, so people teaching at universities, or the management level in the commercial sector and in finance, then the loss is about 70%, right? So try to imagine how you rebuild an economy in a typical market economy setting. After such a shock. So it's a completely different picture, as you already alluded to in your question, between Western and Eastern Europe. And that is important because it means that we can't really explain Eastern Europe's post-war growth performance relative to Western Europe in a way that was traditionally the case until the 1980s, 1990s, that the story starts from 1948-49, because it's essentially a natural experiment. We take two parts of the continent, we set up one set of institutions on one end, the other set of institutions on the other, and see what this institutional divergence leads to in terms of developmental outcomes. It's a very messy natural experiment at best, because the initial shock of World War II and the post-war settlement affects the two parts of Europe in a fundamentally different way. And it's practically impossible, but at least very difficult, to trace, you know, independently the consequences, the persistent consequences of these disruptive effects of the war and the post-war settlement on the one hand, and the institutional divergence that happens on the two sides of the Iron Curtain after 1948-49 on the other.
Taking that into consideration, vastly different starting points, can you provide a sort of a broad outline of how growth rates compared between Eastern Europe and Western Europe with the initial starting points that we've just discussed in mind? But maybe we could go between 1950 to 1989, and maybe we could talk about how the convergence picture looked.
In answering this question, as I did in my 2017 Economic History Review paper that compares economic growth and analyzes it econometrically in different European regions, and also in my recent book chapters co-authored with Andrei Markovic, we answer this question in a way that we compare Eastern Europe's growth performance to two different sets of Western European countries. One that we can call the Western European core. So these would be the usual 10, 12 countries that had reached the status of advanced industrialized nations by the middle of the 20th century. After World War II, they did not engage too many people in agriculture anymore. They had an advanced industrial sector. And then countries that were still more peripheral, and in their level of initial economic development, more comparable to Eastern European countries. So these are the typical Southern European countries, Portugal, Spain, Italy, and Greece, and then in Northern Europe, countries like Ireland and Finland. So if we compare Eastern Europe to the Western core, then what we see is that from the 1950s and 1960s, there was no convergence, but also no divergence, right? So, and you can actually view this in a rather positive way, because we know, as we just talked in response to your first question, Sean, that the post-war period is a golden age of economic growth in Western Europe. It's a very well-known story. And most Western European countries had unprecedented growth rates in this period that are not comparable with anything before or anything since. And therefore, it's actually a good performance or a commendable performance of Eastern European economies that despite a very difficult start after World War II, in terms of growth rates between 1950 and 1978-79, they did not fall behind the Western European core. They only fell behind it very abruptly so in the 1980s, and we can talk about that maybe later. But where Eastern Europe was failing, if you can use that term, is in comparison with the Western peripheries. So both Southern Europe, but also particularly Finland, to some extent also Ireland, in the 50s and the 60s, early 70s, were growing on average 1.5-2 percentage points faster than the average Eastern European growth rate. So while the Western periphery was successful in catching up, not full convergence, but you know, between the 50s and the 80s, closed about half of the development gap, measured either in per capita GDP or in the distribution of the labor force between different sectors with Western Europe, there was no such convergence between East and the Western core. In terms of convergence, we can also say that until the late 70s, you have a similar convergence story in West and East. We all know that the post-war era saw the formation of a convergence club within the OECD and between that in Western Europe. It's a little bit more difficult to demonstrate in Eastern Europe simply because you have fewer countries, so fewer data points. But from the 50s to the 70s, you have a general convergence pattern also in that the initially least developed countries of the Balkans, Yugoslavia, Romania, and Bulgaria were the fastest growing economies of this region. And the smallest growth rates you see in countries like East Germany or Czechoslovakia that were initially the most industrialized had the highest per capita GDP. But in the 1980s, something happens, and not only do growth rates slow down close to zero, but also there is massive divergence. The most developed socialist economies, once again, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, maintain some positive growth, whereas the poorest countries in the region, especially in Southeastern Europe, basically experience zero growth. So that's where we have a divergence. But once again, it's not too dramatically different from the Western story. At least we can see a weaker convergence picture in the 1980s in Western Europe as well that we saw in the Golden Age.
I think a lot of people would be surprised to know it still grew.
And I think it's also very important to know that, you know, we have to realize that this was a period when everybody was falling behind the advanced West, because this was the golden age of growth in the advanced West. I mean, even in the American economy on the frontier, you have near 3% productivity growth. And that's the frontier. And then in West Germany, you know, you have 6, and you have in France or Italy, the same. So it's a very, very fast moving target.
Yeah.
And once you open the picture to the whole globe, I mean, you realize that, you know, one of the things we didn't have when we grew up is the great divergence debate. Now the great divergence debate informed us of this fact that the global growth story since the Industrial Revolution and even before is not convergence, it's divergence. Yeah, everyone is falling behind the West. So if you can maintain the same growth rates or the relative position to the Western core in the 19th and 20th century, that's actually a pretty positive outcome if you are on the periphery. Now, you can explain that in different ways. And of course, there are certain countries that had these catch-up miracles, and they were very extensively talked about until the 80s and the 90s. Everything was about Japan and then Korea and then the pigs and Ireland. Yeah, the Irish growth story. But you realize it's like a couple of percent of the world's population, right? So it's very few countries. And most of the story until at least the 1990s, from then we see a reconvergence. But until from practically somewhere in the 17th century or 18th century to the 1980s, I mean, this is divergence big time.
Yeah.
Right? So if you can grow at reasonable rates in this period, I mean, it's much better than what China was doing for 200 years or India was doing for 200 years or the falling behind of Latin America, which is extreme throughout the 20th century. So I think that's also an issue.
Absolutely. You mentioned Yugoslavia and Romania, and I'm just curious, was their faster growth performance in Eastern Europe down to they didn't have the same demographic disaster?
So definitely there are big differences between countries in this. In fact, the two exceptions would be at the two ends of the kind of convergence story. So Bulgaria, that is probably the poorest of these countries or least developed initially, and then East Germany, which is the most developed initially. So East Germany gets this huge number of refugees from the East, right? So its population is 25% bigger in 1950 than in 1939. But also the other one is Bulgaria. So Bulgaria was never a front. There was no military activity there. And it had a very, very strange role in the Holocaust. Actually, Bulgaria ends up with a bigger Jewish population after the war than before the war. I mean, it was not a major center for Jews in Eastern Europe, so it doesn't suffer from the Holocaust either. And definitely it's true that you know, labor force is much more flexible in both East Germany and Bulgaria, but only for a very short time. In East Germany, this is because of the out-migration to West Germany, which really starts in the 1940s and in the 1950s, it becomes enormous. So this whole population gain is lost to West Germany. And once again, you know, young and middle-aged adults with above average qualifications. So, and the other, in the case of Bulgaria, it's the first huge out-migration of ethnic Turks. There is one big one in the early 50s, and then there is one big one in the 80s. And that actually means also that Bulgaria will have a demographic problem too. Now, in the case of Yugoslavia, this is definitely not the case. I mean, Yugoslavia is one of the biggest, victims of World War II in every way. The issue also is that Eastern Europe is made up of essentially three very different regions, or what we talked about as Eastern Europe in the socialist period is three very different regions. You have these Central European countries that are actually the comparable counterparts to Southern Europe. So, in 1950, if you look at basic things, Czechoslovakia looks like an Italy, Poland looks like a Spain, Hungary looks like a Greece. And you have, similar institutional traditions and quite early state formation and so on and so forth. Then you go to the Balkans, and it's a very different story. I mean, this was the Ottoman Empire until the middle of the 19th century. So the more comparable countries, if you just look at levels of economic development, whatever data you have in the middle of the 20th century, would be more like eastern part, the eastern core of the Ottoman Empire. So Turkey, Syria, Egypt or Iraq or these places. And the Soviet Union, just like in the Book of Allen that you mentioned, the Soviet Union, the best comparison is South America, right? And for Russia, the best comparison is Brazil. And that's why you have this in the BRICS literature, right? Both about institutional traditions, this very the legacy of these very extractive imperial institutions. It's only that it's a different empire. You also have these huge levels of population concentration, and then there are these depopulated peripheries with a lot of resources, but that are very difficult to integrate with the main population centers, some globalization, but limited interaction with the global economy and so on. And if you look at these comparisons, then actually the only one in which Eastern Europe looks bad is the comparison between what today would be the two peripheries of the EU. So the PIGS and the Visegrad countries, right? The PIGS are doing vastly better than Central Europe in under socialism. And this might suggest that, they had very different shocks in the 1940s, very different shocks in the 1980s. We can touch on that maybe a little later. But also that, for more complex economies or more advanced economies, maybe, a more flexible, not pure market economy, but essentially market economy would still function better. However, the other two cases, these comparisons that I drew actually showed that the socialist countries were doing vastly better. I mean, the Soviet Union outperformed South America and Russia outperformed Brazil in any development indicator, despite the fact that one was totally devastated by both world wars, while the other got a massive, primary export boom out of both world war wars and no direct destruction of any sort. If you compare the former Western core of the Ottoman Empire to the former Eastern core of the Ottoman Empire, the same story, except after the oil shocks, because then in the Middle East you have oil, right? So as you said, I mean, what we've learned about this in the last 20 years really changes the classic picture that we had about, communism is just bad for growth, and especially, innovation and technological progress and stuff like that. I mean, it's not that simple.
Coming into the 1980s, you've done a very interesting paper with Alex Klein, where you actually look at what started to break down in those economies coming into 1989. You found some very interesting things with regard to productivity that one might not necessarily expect. Could you just take us through what you looked at and what you found in that paper?
Sure. So let's start with kind of the departure point. So what inspired us, our fundamental disagreement with the traditional literature on why socialism failed or why socialist economies failed. This literature is largely the product of economists and not historians writing mostly in the 80s and the early 90s. On the West, this was based on an understanding of economic performance informed still by the standard neoclassical growth theory, so the solo model and its extensions. And in the East, in the work of people like Janos Kornai or Jan Kalecki, well-known Eastern European economists who were basically comparative economists. And both strands of this literature agreed that this was, this performance or this gradually weakening growth performance of Eastern Europe was due to the intrinsic inefficiencies of the centrally planned economy, some explain this with diminishing returns to capital accumulation. You know, Krugman had this very famous pamphlet in Foreign Affairs in 1994, when he said that there was too much perspiration and not enough innovation. So a lot of resources were accumulated, but they were badly used because the system stifled innovation and creative entrepreneurship. That there was a shortage economy, that as economies got more complex, investment became less and less efficient, and so on. Now, initially, the first growth accounts that were produced for this region were comparatively between this region and Western Europe in, once again, the 1980s and 1990s, confirmed this picture quantitatively because they showed that there were initially high levels of productivity growth, both labor productivity and TFP in the 50s and 60s, and these gradually went to zero, or in the case of the Soviet Union, maybe even negative in the 1980s. So our motive with Alex was that we understood pretty quickly that these early growth accounts were biased by an inconsistent use of data. So these researchers in the 80s and the 90s already benefited from new, more moderate Western estimates of growth in industrial production or in GDP and GDP per capita, but on the other hand, had to continue to rely on official estimates for capital accumulation or estimation of capital stock using inflated official investment data. Now, that was a big literature on the Soviet economy in the 80s, from where everyone knew that these were inflated statistics, but there was nothing better. And then, of course, what happened is that once you take, you know, downward revised estimates of output growth on the one hand, but still using inflated figures on capital accumulation, then obviously you're going to have very low TFP. And if there is a, you know, there are opposite trends in this over time, which we show in our paper, there were, this actually leads to this picture of a rapidly declining rate of total factor productivity growth. So we reestimated, half of our paper is about reestimating capital accumulation, and we showed the effects of inflated investment figures in the 1970s and 1980s, especially. And the outcome of this was that if you look at the growth accounts of Central European socialist countries, in this paper, Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Hungary, then what we see is that there is a slowdown in productivity growth from the golden age to the 70s and the 80s, which we see in other European countries as well, but there is no dramatic slowdown between the 70s and the 80s. So even in the 1980s, these countries continued to produce, you know, reasonable growth rates of productivity growth, both in labor productivity above 2% per annum and in TFP between 1 or 2% per annum. But their actual growth of GDP per capita went to zero or close to zero, and in the case of Poland, into a protracted recession. And we showed that the story of the 80s is not a productivity failure, but a failure to sustain capital accumulation at a high level, or factor accumulation at a high level. On the one hand, labor input stopped growing, partly because they reached the limit. There was very high labor participation, both for men and women, by the end of the 1970s in all these countries. And then also the introduction of a lot of popular reforms, especially maternity benefits and the sort, and early retirement for women, that really began to reduce female labor participation. But also, we showed that the biggest victim of the austerity policies that are introduced in the 1980s in these countries to tackle the consequences of the oil crisis and the sovereign debt crisis that emerged in the aftermath in Eastern Europe, just like other emerging market economies in the world, the main victim was not consumption, either public or private household consumption, but mostly investment. And because these were socialist economies, this means public investment, right? Both in infrastructure and also in machinery. So, you know, the major takeaway of this is that, A, if there was a failure of socialist economies, this was not a gradually failing system that performed relatively well in the beginning and then worse and worse and worse as we go to the 1980s, but there is an abrupt change between a period that lasted from 1950 to, say, 1978-79, and then the next 10 years, the last 10 years of communism, and that it is connected to a global story. So it's not idiosyncratic to Eastern Europe, at least small Eastern European countries outside the Soviet Union. But it's a very similar story that what a typical Western economic historian would know, for instance, from the context of Latin America, right? Where you also have, you know, a changing term, rapidly changing terms of trade. This makes countries insolvent, avalanche of defaults one after the other. Then the IMF comes in, there's very oppressive SAPs or structural adjustment programs are put in place. You have austerity. This stops growth, but also undermines the legitimacy of regimes. And you have revolutions, democratization, and so on. Same story happens in Eastern Europe, practically under a different system, right? So this was our main contribution to understanding, you know, the failure of socialist economies. That we have to focus really on the 1980s, because that's when things go wrong very quickly, and that this is a less idiosyncratic story than what we were told in the 1980s and the 1990s.
So the takeaway there then would be that the traditional narrative, which sees innovation and productivity collapse, is missing the decline of capital investment and the decline of labor hours because of policies, which
exactly. Exactly. And the thing is, you know, you can also see this in other countries that we with Alex did not look at. So here I could refer to several recent papers of my former PhD student, Leo Kukic, who is now at Carlos III in Madrid. He published papers both on national growth accounts and regional growth accounts within socialist Yugoslavia. And what he showed is exactly the same picture, just even in a more dramatic way, because Yugoslavia was the fastest growing country of Eastern Europe and one of the fastest growing countries in post-war Europe until 78, 79, like 5-6% growth rates per year for 30 years. And then it goes to zero for a decade. And exactly the same story, you know, investment rates reaching up to 30-35% by the 70s, and then they are halved in the 80s. So you have these stories everywhere. The one big exception is the USSR itself, which of course dominated the literature, the traditional literature, because it was perhaps the biggest producer and one of the biggest exporters of hydrocarbons in the world. So it gets a big international windfall from this. But on the other hand, in the 1980s, its prime markets in the Comecon, in the Eastern European trading system are collapsing because they are not growing and because their demand is falling. And on the other hand, you have a structural shift because of changing terms of trade, more investment going into peripheral infrastructure to develop more oil and natural gas production and processing, and less attention and investment is going into an already existing, more advanced industrial base that, as I said, is already losing markets in this period. So even in the case of the USSR, this global growth story that is connected to the oil shocks and the sovereign debt crisis in different regions in its aftermath, it's a very negative impact on Soviet economic growth as well.
Professor Tamás Vanyo, thank you very much for a really fascinating discussion.
Thank you very much as well. It was a great opportunity, and I hope that this program continues. I think it's great fun. It's a type of discussion that we seldom have at conferences and other formal settings. So thank you very much for this opportunity. It was great fun.